From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia's President Vladimir Putin made a rare visit to a Russian airbase in Syria Monday and declared victory over the terrorists and announced a partial withdrawal of Russian forces. He said the military was tasked with fighting militia groups, and the task has been achieved. It was the Russian leader's first trip to Syria since Russia intervened in September 2015, allowing Syrian forces to reverse their battlefield losses. After holding talks with Mr. Putin, Syria's leader Bashar al-Assad thanked the Russian and Syrian militaries for what he called their exceptional unity. The Defense Department in the U.S. questioned the extent of the Russian pullout. A Pentagon spokesman said past Russian statements don't often correspond with actual troop reductions. David Lesh, a history professor at Trinity University and a Syria watcher, is equally skeptical.
Putin has announced withdrawal, and there have been mostly a rotation of troops. So I guess in the strict sense of the term, he may be correct, but there's still a lot of action to be seen, I think, by Russian military in Syria.
Meanwhile, Islamic State jihadists have reportedly been driven out by Syrian forces, backed by Russian airplanes from rebel-controlled Idlib province. The bodies of 15 Tanzanian UN peacekeepers killed in Democratic Republic of Congo were repatriated Monday. A memorial service was held in the Congolese town of Beni. The Tanzanian ambassador, Paul Ignace Mello, was on hand.
We continue to pray for all peacekeepers, as this deadly incident is not only Tanzanians. We take it as an incident.
The peacekeepers were killed Thursday in eastern DRC after clashes with suspected Ugandan Muslim rebels of the so-called Allied Democratic Forces. More than 50 others were wounded. This is VOA News. A fifth day of protests against President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital erupted in Lebanon. Russian President Putin, who stopped in Egypt and Turkey after declaring victory in Syria, criticized the U.S. decision. Speaking alongside his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Mr. Putin said the move does not help the situation in the Middle East and actually destabilizes it. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, meeting with European Union officials in Brussels, insisted the declaration only reflects the reality on the ground. But EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini stuck by the view that a two-state solution is the only viable way to achieve peace.
We believe that the only realistic solution to the conflict between Israel and Palestine is based on two states, with Jerusalem as the capital of both the State of Israel and the State of Palestine along the 67 line. This is our consolidated position.
Mr. Netanyahu said Monday he believes most, if not all, European countries will eventually move their embassies to Jerusalem and recognize the city as Israel's capital. While in Ankara, Russian leader Putin and Turkish President Erdogan announced a controversial purchase of a Russian missile system by Turkey should be finalized this week. Turkey is a member of NATO. The alliance said it strongly opposes the deployment as incompatible with its own systems. A 27-year-old man from Bangladesh is suspected Monday of setting off a homemade pipe bomb strapped to his body in a crowded New York subway system, wounding himself and three others. The suspect, Aliad Ula, has been hospitalized, suffering burns from the explosive device that did not fully ignite. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio called it an attempted terrorist attack.
Thank God the perpetrator did not achieve his ultimate goals. Thank God our first responders were there so quickly to address the situation to make sure people were safe.
New York suffered another so-called lone wolf attack 6 weeks ago when an Uzbek man plowed a truck into a group of pedestrians, killing eight. Another earthquake jolted Kermanshah province in western Iran Monday, registering 6.0 magnitude in the same region struck by last month's 7.3 magnitude tremor that killed hundreds. A Ukrainian court has ordered the release of former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili, who stands accused of trying to orchestrate a coup. A judge rejected a request by prosecutors to keep Saakashvili under house arrest. He told reporters he plans to continue what he called constitutional calm, but a necessary transfer of power in Ukraine. Just 2 days before a U.S. central bank decision on hiking a key interest rate, U.S. stocks continued to surge forward, led by technology issues. The benchmark Dow Jones Index closed nearly 60 points higher to 24,386. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi wants its citizens to pay for the country's 2020 election through taxation.
The Home Affairs Minister announced that actually Burundians are obliged to contribute to the 2020 general elections, whereby each home has to contribute around, that is, 2,000 Burundi local francs. That's estimated at around more than $1.
That's reporter Moses Javier Rimana in Bujumbura. More nationwide anti-Kabila protests are planned for December 19 in the DRC. There are mixed opinions in Zimbabwe about the role former First Lady Grace Mugabe played in the downfall of her husband. And Cameroonian authorities condemned Monday's suicide bombing of a mosque that killed two people.
This is their practical way of assassinating and murdering people. Two persons carrying a belt of bomb, they triggered their bomb and it exploded, killing people and wounding others.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Information. Gambian parliamentarians are urged to reject a new constitution that is being pushed by the Justice Minister. And we will talk with an environmentalist about protecting Guinea-Bissau's fish and birds. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi announced Monday that it will ask its citizens to pay for the country's 2020 general election. The country's Home Affairs Minister said the government will raise the money from the salaries of civil servants as well as household contributions. Burundi in the past has depended on foreign aid, but donors like the European Union cut direct aid to the government because of human rights violations and suppression of the opposition. Reporter Moses Javier Rimana in Bujumbura says the government wants every household to pay about 2,000 francs, an equivalent of $1.14 a year, and civil servants will give about one-tenth of their monthly salaries.
Last evening, the Home Affairs Minister announced that actually Burundians are obliged to contribute to the 2020 general elections, whereby each home has to contribute around, that is, 2,000 Burundi local francs. That's estimated at around more than $1. And also students who are at the age of voting, that is above 18, will also be having to contribute around 1,000 Burundian francs. That's around 5 cents to the 2020 general election. It is an annual contribution, and it will be lasting for at least 2 years from now. That means in 2020, when the general election is expected to be conducted.
Moses, in reality, this is a tax on the people. Has this happened before, and how did Burundi pay for its elections in the past?
We understand that this have actually started as Burundians were just goodwilling, and it was voluntarily they were trying to, you know, to contribute in these 2020 elections since last year. But just to make you remind about how Burundi was contributing to the general elections, it's all the aid from the European Union and the US were able to support the Burundi government in terms of also realizing the annual budget, which contributed to the 50% of the budget. But since 2016, when reports raised about the human rights violations in the crisis that erupted in 2015, the European Union and the United States have pulled out the direct aid, suspended the direct aid to the Burundi government. So we have seen some measures have been taken by the Burundi government in order to support its budget, and also now again comes also to affect also the elections, whereby even now people now are more obliged to take part in the payment of the general elections, which should be expected to take place in 2020.
Is the government going to force the people to make this contribution, or is it going to be voluntary?
Actually, it's not going to be voluntary. We understand that since the beginning of this year, it was kind of voluntary, whereby the president himself was calling on the citizens and the goodwill who can come in and contribute to the 2020 general elections, whereby they have also made a specific bank account, which whereby people can go and deposit the money voluntarily. But however, now it was only yesterday which came up, whereby the Minister of Home Affairs announced it's going to be now possibly compulsory for every citizen of Burundians to contribute in the general elections.
I wanted to ask you before I let you go, Moses. The cabinet came up with a draft legislation to change the constitution so that President Nkurunziza can run for a fourth term. in 2020. Now, where are we? What is the status of this referendum?
We expect the Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza to officially launch the campaigns in Gitega. We expect government officials to be there. They're going to official launching of the referendum campaign, whereby people will be able to be sensitized about what's the use of changing the constitutions and, you know, something like that.
First reporter Moses Javier Rimana speaking with us from Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Cameroonian authorities have condemned Monday's suicide bombing of a mosque in the northern part of the country near the Nigerian border that killed two people. No one has claimed responsibility, but the area is prone to attacks by Boko Haram insurgents. Minister of Information Issa Chiroma Bakari says Boko Haram terrorists have been acting sporadically in the face of their diminishing influence in Cameroon. But he admits it is possible the terrorist group may still have accomplices inside Cameroon.
This is their practical way of assassinating and murdering people. Two persons carrying a belt of bomb, they triggered their bomb and it exploded, killing people and wounding others. But this is the way that they used to operate.
Mr. Minister, we thought maybe your government had some control now, some upper hand on Boko Haram. It seems to me Boko Haram still has some people in your country.
No, not at all. Indeed, it is impossible peremptorily to say that they don't have their accomplice in Cameroon. It is possible, but the extent of their power, the capacity of their nuisance has completely diminished in a such a way that they are acting very sporadically.
So let me ask you, Mr. Minister, about this Cameroonian-American writer. His name is Patrice Ungana. He's a professor at New York's Stony Brook University. We hear that he is not being allowed to leave the country, that he's, your government is about to put him on trial because his writings have been critical of president of your government.
No, not critical. When you say critical, you didn't say it as it is. He has been arrested, red-handed, inciting people to overthrow the regime through violence. And he himself said that if he had a gun, he would shot kill the president. And you can find it in his Facebook. It is possible to find it. And he cannot deny it. He said that he is the author of this, and he is a writer, and he is authorized to write and to author such a threat against the head of state. He has been arrested and brought to the inquiry and judicial police office for nothing. He has been arrested red-handed. Right now, he's being investigated.
Mr. Ngana said that he's a peaceful person. He's non-violent, and he is not a threat to your government.
Take notice of what he has seen himself reading in his Facebook. You will find it. He threatened to kill the head of state. And he could not deny it. He has admitted being the author of what was written in his Facebook. He assumed it.
So are you detaining him because do you feel he has connection with the secessionist movement in your country?
I don't know. At this level, at this stage of inquiry, it is impossible to make such a connection with secessionist investigation. Which is taking place. A thorough investigation will be led in order to enlighten the government to let us know who is who, what is taking place, and where. But as far as I am concerned, the information brought to my knowledge does not testify that it has any link with them. We don't know.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 12th. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The Democratic Republic of Congo's main opposition party, the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, UPDS, says it, together with other opposition groups, will have another nationwide demonstration on December 19th. To pressure President Joseph Kabila to step down. This as Mr. Kabila has pledged to honor the new election calendar outlined by the country's Electoral Commission, which calls for election in December 2018. But the UPDS and the opposition coalition known as the Rassemblement have rejected the new calendar and are demanding the immediate resignation of President Kabila. Abraham Luakabuanga, spokesperson for the UPDS, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the demonstrations would proceed as planned because President Kabila has proven to be untrustworthy over the years to hand over power.
The message is clear, is all the opposition, all the organization, NGO, we have said that for 2018, President Kabila should not be into power. We also thinking that though we have a calendar for 2018, there are 17 obstructions, if I may say so, that have to be filled. We're talking about money, we're talking about the law being voted, and a lot of things that have to be taking place right now, and this 2018 won't be the year for elections. So we say the main problem in the DRC is President Kabila, and once he's going to be out of the picture, we can have a transition of 6 months and having elections before December 30th, 2018.
How do you plan on getting that done, particularly when the government has come out through the foreign minister, Manuel Augusto, that President Kabila has pledged to honor his country's new electoral calendar?
You know, how many times President Kabila has assured Congolese people and the international community that he was going to organize elections? I do remember a few years ago he said that he's going to be respectful of the constitution. But he tried and failed just because we had the opposition in front of him to change one of the key articles of the constitution that was able to give him a third term. So it's not trustworthy. Also remember, for the Franco Kabila, when we proposed the Felix Tshisekedi, when we proposed the censor, President Tshisekedi, the late, he also, you know, didn't go that way since the death of President Tshisekedi. So since President Kabila, that we deeply think that he has to resign and let all the forces, political forces and the social forces in the DRC, to sit down together in a dialogue or another form of talks, that we, and then we're going to decide who can lead the transition in the DRC for only 6 months.
So what makes you think that your planned protests or demonstrations across the country on December 19th will be effective to put pressure on him to step down?
If you take a look at what happened on November 30th, even the president, Felix Tshisekedi, was home with hundreds of police services trying to break into his house. They failed because he called for no school on that day. There were no school. He called for no business. There were no business. He called for no marketplace. That also happened. So Congolese people were only scared because of the way that they're using weapons. But the message is clear. And I can tell you, as of today in Kinshasa, students of the UNITIN, which is one of the biggest universities, you know, they had their own march today asking, you know, the situation in Congo to change.
Abraham Luakabuanga is the spokesperson for the Union for Democracy and Social Progress Party in the DRC. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Kinshasa. There are mixed opinions in Zimbabwe over the role that former First Lady Grace Mugabe played in the downfall of her husband Robert Mugabe. Patricia Mudadigwa reports from Harare.
Political power grabber or just another match to a burning fire? Those are just some of the opinions Zimbabweans have about former First Lady Grace Mugabe. Tinashe Mawere is a researcher in the Department of Historical and Heritage Studies and Center for Sexualities, AIDS and Gender at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He blames Grace Mugabe for widening the factional fights in ZANU-PF.
She clearly had control over Mugabe and therefore made certain decisions in favor of Generation 40 group. So in this case, she's actually seen as usurping the powers of the president. She had actually become the de facto president of the nation.
Mawere says Grace should also answer to the accusations. Political activist and aspiring independent member of parliament for 2018, Linda Masarira, also blames Mrs. Mugabe for her husband's ouster. Masarira thinks the president fell because his wife had encroached onto political territory that was not hers.
She was only a first lady and not the president of this country, but she had assumed roles of appointing and removing ministers. She had taken a role of wanting to take charge of Zimbabwe, which was very wrong because she was not the elected president of Zimbabwe. So for me, I think she took advantage of the president's old age and she wanted to take over as she was the president's wife, which was actually what led to the downfall of Mugabe.
Masarira suggests that Grace Mugabe should be brought before the courts to answer charges that she displaced other citizens and was involved in corruption. However, there are others who believe that the former president caused his own downfall. Acting director for the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, Bekezela Gombo, says Mrs. Mugabe merely added on to a singing board. Gombo says that Robert Mugabe had already developed strained relationships with the security sector, which he adds is the backbone of ZANU-PF. This was supported by Sibonwe Kuhle-Mpulungu, a gender activist who thinks the fire had already started burning around the president before Mrs. Mugabe started making political waves.
The president himself contributed immensely to his own downfall. Grace only played a minor role, according to me. All she did was to put petrol in a fire that was already burning.
Mpulungu thinks it is not necessary for Mrs. Mugabe to be punished. Women rights activist Lucy Makaza Masingi says Mrs. Mugabe was a victim of men around her who used her.
There were men around Grace Mugabe who had political interests, and they were using her in a way to make sure that they get power. It was all about power. And I think Grace Mugabe did not realize that.
Grace Mugabe was known for her rantings at every party gathering. She has also been accused of pushing former Vice President Joyce Mujuru out of ZANU-PF. She also belittled government officials, including former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is now the president through the help of the army. Reporting for Studio 7 in Harare, this is Patricia Mudadigwa.
A leading member of the Gambian parliament is calling on his colleagues to reject a new constitution tabled in the National Assembly by the country's justice minister. Khalifa Sala said his fellow MPs risk being charged with treason if they approve the proposed constitution. As Pandere Umbai reports, Sala addressed the parliament on Monday.
Gambia's justice minister's attempt to table a bill that will pave the way for a new constitution to be ushered in the Gambia has suffered a major setback. Khalifa Sala, MP for Sarikunda, has raised an objection for the proposed bill. Mr. Sala said the justice minister, Abubakar Tambedu, has failed to follow the constitutional procedures that will enable such a bill to be approved.
Clause 23 is saying, upon the enactment of the National Assembly of the bill, approving the constitution, the speaker shall, following the assent of the president, immediately transmit a copy of the constitution to the Independent Electoral Commission. The commission, meaning the Independent Electoral Commission, shall within 60 days of receiving a copy of the constitution in accordance with subsection 1, organize a referendum on the constitution. This is a complete variant.
Therefore, Mr. Sala warns that any attempt by the National Assembly to entertain the minister's proposed bill would amount to treason.
So in that regard, I must say that if the National Assembly passes this bill, what we are simply saying is that we have overthrown the 1997 Constitution and will be deserved to be charged with treason. Because it's clear under Section 6 of the Constitution that it is our duty to defend the Constitution.
Minister Tambedu had earlier told MPs that if the proposed bill is approved, the Constitutional Review Commission is expected to consult with Gambians both at home and abroad, including professional groups, on the proposed constitution. Tambedu says the commission would be mandated to draft a new constitution, but Khalifa Sala maintains that power belongs to the people and therefore the current constitution should be respected.
The people are the real lawmakers. We are here simply representing them. We are not the lawmakers. We are lawmakers indirectly giving the power of the people to make law for them. So, but the people are the real lawmakers.
The proposed new constitution promotes for separation of powers, the independence of the judiciary, national unity, cohesion, and peace. It also catered for term limit for the office of the president and the Gambia being an independent sovereign state. Parliament is expected to vote on the proposed bill. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pande Rimbai reporting.
During her 3 years studying birds and predatory fish in the Bigiles Island chain off the coast of Guinea-Bissau, Edna Correira worked with local residents using participatory conservation methods. Through this work, she realized that it's important that biologists understand that small fish such as sardinella, which are a main target of fishermen in the region, are essential to the island's unique biodiversity and function as a winter grounds for birds and fish from Europe.
In terms of biodiversity, very rich. We know that there's a lot of abundance of predatory fishes and fishes in general. And also for the birds, we know that they gather together in high densities, mainly during the winter. They come from Europe and North Africa, and they go there to spend the winter.
During your 3 years of research, did you find that there were legitimate threats to this habitat for the birds and the predatory fishes that are endangering their ability to winter in the Bajagos?
I was working, as I said, in Emerin National Park, where in most an important area, fishing is forbidden and there are lots of restrictions. So maybe it's a good place for them because there's not a lot of threats. Although there are still, we can observe some illegal fishing from people from the country and from foreigners, like from Senegal and Guinea-Conakry.
Within the Bajagos, you know, there aren't that many inhabitants of the 89-island archipelago, but there are about 30,000 people who live there. Conservation, though, is very ingrained in their religion, in their way of life. Did you do any work looking at how the culture works to preserve the environment?
In the islands where I work, people go there only for doing some agriculture and for religious stuff. So in that island, I think people don't harm a lot the biodiversity.
I've seen the term participatory conservation. What does that mean? Can you give me kind of a definition and how that affects the environment?
Yeah, that means that when we are working there in the Bajagos Archipelago, we debug, we always work with local people. So we teach people from the villages that live there. In my islands where I work, there are four islands, and as they are like sacred, they belong to four different villages. Each island belongs to one village from another island. So we pick some people from each of these villages and we work with them. We teach them how to do our work and how to help us. As I was working with fish, they were fishing with me and they were identifying the fish species.
That was Edna Correia, a researcher and biologist at the University of Lisbon. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Lisbon. That is it for this Tuesday, December 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barty in Washington wishing you in Africa a nice day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.